Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. On the show today, amendments drastically alter a bill to ban conversion therapy in Utah, leading to the resignation of a prominent LGBTQ advocate from a state suicide task force. Also, Utah lawmakers abandon a proposed tax overhaul for now. And prosecutors drop counts against a medical cannabis patient who was facing drug charges. On the show today to talk about these and other stories, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. And good morning and welcome, Matt.
Good morning.
We've also got reporter Bethany Rogers. Bethany, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Hi, Robert. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Join this conversation. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com. Tweet us at KCPW or call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's start with the effort to get conversion therapy banned in the state of Utah. And actually, Bethany Rogers, before we turn to those legislative efforts, can we first talk about what conversion therapy is? Can you define it for us?
Sure, yeah. So it covers a broad array of specific therapeutic practices that are basically all aimed at changing someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. But it can involve a lot of different techniques, from physical techniques. You know, there's been stories about people, you know, being shocked in this type of therapy, or just people who have been in talk therapy that's designed to change their, as I said, sexual orientation or gender identity.
Mm-hmm. This is a pretty widely discredited practice, right?
Yeah, all the leading medical and mental health associations have basically discredited the practice,
saying that it's, you know, beyond being ineffective and not. That you can't actually convert a person's sexuality. It's also been shown to be harmful as well.
Yes, it's ineffective, and it's also linked to higher risk of depression and even suicidal ideation.
Okay. Okay, so let's go to the bill. This is a measure by West Valley City Republican Representative Craig Hall. What was the aim of this bill as it was introduced?
The bill was designed kind of in keeping with the conversion therapy bans that have already passed in 15 other states across the nation. The goal of it would be to prohibit state-licensed therapists from practicing this sort of therapy on minors, so people under the age of 18. It did have a carve-out for clergy, and it would not have applied to unlicensed counselors like life coaches, but for state-licensed therapists, it would have banned conversion therapy.
Would have banned the practice altogether. And then in a House committee this week, this bill got, as we said, changed, and it was changed pretty drastically. What happened in committee?
There was a lot of discussion among the committee members about freedom of speech, and there was a concern about a chilling effect that the bill would have had on therapists. So they passed some pretty drastic amendments to the bill, and whereas the original bill would have prohibited, as I said, conversion therapy is a broad category, and it would have prohibited it as a broad category. This would have focused on the physical forms of conversion therapy involving physical discomfort, as I mentioned. Exactly, yeah. Making someone nauseous, shocking someone, stuff like that, stuff that causes pain or physical discomfort to someone. It would have also prohibited therapists from basically claiming that they are able to change someone's sexual orientation, but it would have completely left, individuals who are transgender completely unprotected. It did not contain protections for trying to change gender identity. And it would have also, the advocates say, been easily sidestepped by people who practice the talk therapy form of conversion therapy.
Okay, so I mean, essentially, it wouldn't be a ban on conversion therapy in the state of Utah, other than than those categories that you laid out. What were the? I mean, who presented these amendments, and what were the reasons that these? Why were they? They said they were protecting therapists, the therapeutic community. Is that?
Yeah, and I should mention there that a lot of therapists said that they did not need to be protected. A lady from the Utah Psychological Association even came forward and said this would have continued to allow counselors and therapists to practice professional forms of therapy uninhibited. However, there were some therapists, advocates told me they were primarily conversion therapists, who came in saying that this would have stifled their practice. And, you know, people were pushing the bill, say, good, that's exactly what we wanted to happen in the first place. So the people who were behind the amendment, Representative Lisenby was the one who offered the substitute bill, and Representative Brammer also worked closely with her on it.
And those changes also had, as I understand from the reporting, the support of the governor, Governor Gary Herbert.
Yeah, it was kind of an 11th hour thing in the middle of the committee hearing where they were considering this. You had one representative from Gary Herbert coming out and saying, I support the Craig Hall's version of the bill, the stronger version of the bill. Then later in the meeting, Representative Lisenby announced she had gotten a message from another representative of the governor's office saying he was also supportive of her version.
I'm just going to remind listeners to join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or tweet us at KCPW. After those changes were implemented, I mean, these changed Representative Hall's initial bill, and then that passed, right?
Passed committee, yeah.
Okay. I want to bring in Robert Gerke, who is a news columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune. You wrote about this in your column, and you pointed out the research showing the harm that is caused by conversion therapy, which has been disavowed, as we said, by the vast majority of mental health and medical associations. And you pretty strongly called out the sponsor of the amendments to this bill. Can you tell us about that, Robert?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at the data, there's a study out of a university in San Francisco that says that people who go through this therapy are 2 to 3 times as likely to be depressed or to commit suicide. As Bethany mentioned, all of the major psychological and psychiatric associations in the country have disavowed it and said that basically that homosexuality is not a disease that needs to be cured. And so that's sort of the fundamental part of this, is that when you go through conversion therapy, no matter how they're doing it, you're starting at a premise that there's something wrong with the patient that you're going to try to repair or fix. And that puts the patient in a place where they don't feel comfortable in their own self, you know, and it creates a problem where, because conversion therapy typically does not work for the long term. And in fact, the studies have said that there's not a single incident that they can identify where it has been effective permanently. If you can't cure the patient, then the patient goes on feeling like they're less than themselves. And so it has this dehumanizing effect. And so that's why they want to put an end to this. The tactics they use, as Bethany mentioned, the electroshock, the nausea-inducing medicines and things like that, the aversion therapy, are one part of this. But the other part of it is just where psychiatrists and psychologists are starting from a place that, according to the accepted medical practices, it's not something that is widely accepted. So Lisenby comes with this proposal that there were numerous conversion therapists there, people who said they'd gone through conversion therapy effectively. I think, was it just the one gentleman and his wife who said that he had gone through it and been cured, who wanted this to remain an option. This has traditionally been, at least, a practice that is predominantly done in religious settings, by, you know, recommended by religious institutions, because they, you know, view homosexuality as something that is evil and a sin. Interestingly, on this one, the bill that Craig Hall was proposing, after weeks and months, frankly, of working with the LDS Church on it, they came to a position where the church was neutral on it. The church has publicly disavowed conversion therapy. They don't recommend it. But Representative Lisenby, Representative Brammer, came with this proposal that you know, from my perspective, would acknowledge that this is a legitimate form of a legitimate practice, and put it in code that there are protections for these doctors, these psychiatrists who do this. And so effectively the bill got killed, because Representative Hall said that essentially that this bill is worse than nothing. Right now, it's, you know,
because it would enshrine the practice.
It puts the practice right in code, you know, and gives it some legitimacy that it shouldn't have. And so they've basically pulled the plug on it because right now he says the risk of a bad bill passing is too great to move forward with it.
Do we have, Bethany, I don't know if you've looked at this, but do we have data on how often so-called conversion therapy is still practiced in Utah? I mean, nobody advertises that they do this or try to do this, I should say, but that doesn't mean that it isn't happening right now, right?
That's true. So when I spoke with the advocates behind the bill, Equality Utah, they said that because of just what you just referred to, the fact that people don't advertise this, it's very difficult to get a sense of how prevalent this is. It's definitely happening. They conducted a survey, I believe, last year, and they got, I believe, 100 responses from people who had said that they experienced some form of conversion therapy. And a lot of people came forward to testify during the committee hearings about this and in this whole process, stepped forward and said, yes, I've been subjected to this. But as far as numbers, no, we don't have that.
Has Representative Lissenby spoken in favor of conversion therapy in the past? I mean, does she believe that you can change this fundamental part of a person's identity through therapy? Is this, she says something different than that in her amendments, right? I mean, she's trying to address what she thinks are problems for therapists, I guess, not so much I don't know. It's a weird question. If you don't know the answer to, like, has she spoken in favor of conversion therapy? Do we know?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think her rationale was that we don't want doctors to jeopardize their licenses for saying the wrong thing, for crossing a line that is a little bit maybe shades of gray, maybe a little blurry. I mean, and so they were trying to strike this balance with these conversion therapists to where they could make sure that these doctors are not, losing their state licenses.
I do want to say, too, the version that she put forward, it would have prohibited the therapist from saying that changing someone's sexual orientation is possible. But it struck out language from the original version that related to expressions, behaviors, and attractions, because I think that some of the committee discussion related to, if people want to change their behavior, maybe that doesn't change who they are internally, but if they want to live a certain way, they should be allowed to go and get therapy in line with that.
Okay. There's some additional fallout to all of this, Bethany. A prominent activist from the LGBTQ community, he resigned from a governor-appointed state commission over this. Actually, there was more than one resignation. And then Governor Herbert ended up apologizing to some young activists over his support for this. These are two separate but related stories. Can you kind of fill us in on both of those, Bethany?
Yes. So the first story, the day after all of this went down in committee, the executive director of Equality Utah, Troy Williams, held a press conference announcing he was stepping off of the governor's youth suicide task force. And it was related to what happened with the conversion therapy bill. He had been working on this bill in part to address the problem of suicide among, the LGBTQ community for young people. And his feeling was that Governor Herbert's decision to support the substitute and the changes to the bill were really a betrayal of that. So he stepped off, and then also an advocate on suicide prevention stepped off as well, just sort of in protest over these things. Just yesterday, there were a group of young LGBTQ activists who were so upset about Governor Herbert's support for the substitute that they decided to come and camp out basically right outside his office and just sit there until they got an apology from him. And they did. After several hours, they got their apology.
What does that apology – does that apology signal that the that conceivably Representative Hall's bill, and this is a question for Robert Gerke, could, come back from the dead. Is he apologizing for, and maybe, what did his apology say actually first, Bethany, before we turn to Robert Gerke?
His apology referred to some enormous misunderstanding. It wasn't clear exactly what that misunderstanding was, but in some tweets, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox had kind of alluded to the fact that it was clear the original bill wasn't going to pass. And so behind the scenes, the governor decided, well, some bill is better than no bill. So he decided to support the substitute, but he wasn't really excited about it. The letter didn't exactly explain what went on there and exactly what he was apologizing for, other than that it was some misunderstanding and that he had no intention of hurting anyone by supporting the fourth substitute.
Robert Kirky, that apology letter from Governor Herbert that these activists secured. I guess the question that I had was, does that mean that the bill could become unamended? Is there, a pressure at the legislature to keep the original thing intact or not?
Let's start with acknowledging these young people who, rallied in a short time frame, and applied enough pressure to make the governor and the lieutenant governor acknowledge that they had botched this. And so that in itself, I think, is an accomplishment. Now, where it goes, I think nothing's dead until they adjourn on the last day.
Thursday of next week.
The bill could be moved forward, and there was some talk initially about, well, let's just get it out of the House, get it over the Senate, and try to fix it there. And that's still a possibility. When I last spoke with Representative Hall, it was, preceded, the events yesterday with this apology and this acknowledgement. So there is the potential that could happen. I think it's probably unlikely. And the way the governor's apology was written, it sort of was talking about, going forward, let's work on this, not let's get this passed. And so I think what you're more likely to see is some effort over the interim, over the summer, spring and summer months, to try to come to some language that maybe is acceptable.
Bethany, just on the bill as amended, is there any plan? I mean, Robert Kirky's saying it's probably going to wait, but is there any plan for floor debate? I mean, we've got a week left in the session just before we head to a break here. Have we seen any kind of plans to move it onto House debate on the House floor?
No, not at this point. I mean, it's really on hold right now. And Representative Hall and Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox last night said that the issue here is really dealing with lawmakers and explaining the issue to them, and that'll take time. So because of that, they plan to do this kind of, as Robert said, over the interim.
And I don't remember the exact time frame, but there is a deadline for the House to pass House bills, and that's coming up pretty fast if it hasn't already passed.
Okay. We will keep watching. For the moment, though, we need to take a quick break here on the show. When we come back, we'll turn to more from the legislative session, including the postponement of a tax overhaul. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Why is the world so cynical?
Why is the default mode the ironic mode? If you get a group of young people in a room and you start talking about this problem, it just comes flooding out how hungry people are for an irony-free interaction with another human being.
Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio. Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU School of Applied Sciences, Technology, and Education Collegiate FFA, offering students the opportunity to enhance the collegiate experience through activities that promote leadership, personal growth, and career success.
Utah Public Radio is everywhere you are, with news, information, and musical programming statewide via our 6 transmitters and 30 translator signals. Worldwide on the web at upr.org and through our new online app. UPR is only a push of the button away.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporter Bethany Rogers, and news columnist Robert Kirky. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or tweet us at KCPW. A lot of options there. Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor of the Tribune. I was teeing up a story about what happened to a tax reform proposal before we went to the break, but let's actually start with an update on hate crimes legislation, if that's okay.
Sure.
This is something that in previous years did not fare so well at the session. This year, though, a measure to give our hate crimes law some teeth is pretty far along. Where is it, and what hurdles does it have left to clear? Matt?
At this very second, it is in a House committee. There is final comments being made by members of the committee, and we will expect to vote momentarily.
Okay, maybe we'll circle back in the show to see what happens to it.
Right.
But, maybe I'll ask for an opinion from our opinion columnist, Robert Gerke. Is this going to get through the House? And, you know, is it a priority for Speaker Wilson, who sort of sets the agenda there, if it makes its way through this committee?
Yeah, I think the prospects for this passing in the House are still kind of up in the air. I mean, it's going to be close. It's Matt, did you have an update?
Yes. The vote was 8-2. It passed committee, so it's going to the House floor for a final debate, and we'll see what this vote is there.
Yeah. So, I mean, this has been a long time coming. I know Representative Perry has been talking to I spoke with him this week, and he said he's been, you know, talking to his colleagues. A lot of them have come around on this issue, I think. I think Representative Perry himself, the House sponsor of the bill, is one who's come around on this issue. He wasn't a supporter before. And he's, you know, over time has been turned, I guess, on this issue. So, you know, there are a few things that happened that have made this possible. And I think maybe the biggest one, it happened before the session when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which had traditionally been seen as opposing the bill, made a statement that said that they are neutral on it. And then there were some additions to the bill that sort of satisfied Senate President Stuart Adams, who was not comfortable with the broad classifications of people who are protected, because the way the bill was written before, it wanted to cast the net broadly. Everybody, you know, so you protect gender, you know, everybody's got a gender, everybody's got a race, everybody's got a religion. So you protect those categories. And then there were other things that were added to it.
Sure.
We saw matriculation added to it. So the BYU fan who tries to beat up a Utah fan, for example, because they're a Utah fan, could be charged, presumably,
under the bill. Is that still in this bill?
That's still in this bill. There's one other thing that I believe it was Representative Brammer tried to add. Oh, no, it wasn't Representative Brammer. It was Senator Cullimore tried to add in the Senate that would cover creed and political ideology. And that was defeated. I suspect you'll probably see that come back in the House. That's a little problematic because political ideology can be somewhat fluid.
He talked about people wearing MAGA hats.
And that's what they're looking at. Yeah.
Make America Great Again
hats. Yeah. The Trump supporter wearing the Make America Great hat or the, you know, the Clinton supporter or whatever. That's a little problematic. And also because political speech, generally speaking, has a higher level of First Amendment protection than other forms of speech. Your matriculation, for example. That's a little problematic. And creed was obviously a term that was very squishy. You know, typically it's a term applied to religious beliefs, which is already, religion is already protected. So anyway, you'll probably see that come back. You might see other attempts to amend it to try to water it down a little bit. But
this would mean, I mean, if it passes, it would mean enhanced penalties for people who have committed a crime they carry out that crime, they singled out someone for their race, religion, sexual orientation, or because of these other attributes that you're describing, right?
These are enhancements.
It's not a crime itself.
Yeah, you're charged with a crime, you're convicted, it's a sentencing enhancement that you did it with a hate crime in mind. So there has to be some evidence that you were trying to target a group or for some one of these classifications.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Thatcher's tried to rebrand it, I guess, and not call it a hate crimes bill. He calls it a victim selection or a victim targeting bill. And so that's sort of a spin on it. And I think, you know, we saw that over the summer, or I guess fall, we saw the attack on the people at Lopez Tires, where the guy beat him with a pole saying he wanted to kill some Mexicans. And you know, Salt Lake District Attorney Sim Gill said he was helpless to try to charge that as a hate crime because the statute that is on the books, the courts have said, really can't be enforced. And so that also kind of provided a little, I think, incentive to try to get this passed.
Well, and it's now, as we said, just passed a House committee just barely. Now, and is on to the House floor, which is the, you know, once it gets past that, all it has is the governor's signature left. So this is the last, the final.
Yep. There'll be one more showdown in the days to come, and we'll see if there are – I mean, there are people who don't think that this bill should go through, that they think that the criminal statute as it stands treats everyone equally, and that if you start listing classifications, you're treating them in a different way than everyone else. that argument has not worked in the Senate. It did not work in a House committee. This is by far the farthest this bill has ever got, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, SB 103, a bill to keep watching. Now, Matt, let's turn to the tax overhaul. Matt Canham, lawmakers at the Utah Capitol were working on this big tax reform proposal. I mean, we're going to see substantial changes to the tax system. Services were going to be taxed. This was an overhaul that some observers say was already a long time coming, but now it's going to be a longer time coming. What happened, Matt?
Lobbyists. Lots and lots of lobbyists for lots and lots of groups and industries and professions did not like the idea that their area was going to be taxed, added to the sales tax, and they fought it. And what happened is, with few days left in the session and in this big of a complication or this complicated of a bill, the governor and legislative leaders decided they can't get this done in this short time period. The legislative session ends next Thursday. This thing hasn't even come up for a vote in the House where the bill started. So they're going to hit pause, finish the session, try to keep talking about it. And the governor was hoping to have a special session sometime this summer to bring this back. This is the idea here is that our sales tax applies to things you buy, but not everything in which you spend your money on. And the things that we buy are becoming a smaller part of our economy. So the government doesn't have as much flexibility with the money that it wants to. And so the idea would be to lower the sales tax on everything, but add it to more things. Things like car washes and haircuts and funerals and legal services and a variety of other things, ads on radio and TV and newspaper subscriptions, lots of things. And every time you add a tax, there's a group that's upset about it.
Sure. I mean, and the sponsor of the bill said that he was trying to, you know, the effort was to try to, quote, piss off everybody equally.
He succeeded.
Yeah, he succeeded to such an extent that his bill's not going anywhere. There were also concerns about education funding, right? Planned cuts to the income tax would cut education funding. Can you talk about that part of this?
Yeah. So just to set this up, I know that Bethany and Robert have a lot that they can add to this conversation as well, but this comes in the backdrop of the governor and legislative leader saying they were going to do a huge tax cut. And so this was the bill that was going to be the vehicle for that. This switch how our tax system works, but then provide a cut. And part of that cut was going to come in income taxes. When you pay income taxes in the state of Utah, that money is supposed to go to public education. In recent years, a growing part of that has gone to higher education as well. We all know that Utah has the lowest per pupil spending for public education in our country. We know that there are, you know, classrooms where there's between 30 and 40 students, that it's a system that needs money. You cut the income tax, you cut money for schools. The Utah Education Association was not okay with that. And they're asking, if you need to change how we do sales taxes, great, but why are you taking money from the income tax? And that was to serve this tax cut. Will that happen in the months to come as they continue to put this package together? We'll see, but that's one that will also be part of the fight.
And so this bill, though, just the HB 441, which was the tax reform bill, it's dead in the water, right? I mean, it's they're not. They're
they had a big news conference yesterday to say we are done for this session, but we are going to come back in the months to come.
I don't know who to turn this question to, but this disconnect between the need to overhaul the, you know, update the tax system, we're still going to want to, you know, offset the impacts of that with a an income tax cut, and that will impact education funding. Or, I mean, that's what's going to happen, and then they're still going to face that same opposition in the future. Robert Gerke, maybe the legislature is going to study this and then come back likely with a special session to address it. No matter what happens, some people are going to be unhappy, and that makes lawmakers unpopular. Can this get done?
It's hard. I mean, it's a hard lift. I wrote a month ago that I thought that the likeliest outcome was that they were going to punt, just because you start messing with these huge, powerful lobbies, the bankers, the doctors, the lawyers, the real estate people. Those are the most powerful lobbies up there. And so you start saying, we want to start taxing your services, you know, you're going to meet some really stiff opposition. there's a consensus. Everybody you talk to says something needs to be done to fix this system because it's out of whack. It's out of alignment. The education fund's growing really rapidly, but the general fund that funds everything else in government is not. And so they've got to try to rebalance it in some way. And everybody agrees on that. The question is, how do you do it? And when you get into the intricacies, for example, I mean, I'll just throw a couple out there without getting too far into the weeds, but there's two kinds of chartered credit unions, one a federal credit union, one a state credit union. It turns out state credit unions would have to pay sales tax on the services they provide, investment advising and things like that. Federal credit unions wouldn't. So then you have this dual system for credit unions. You have things like, okay, if you're an attorney, if you're a small business and you hire an attorney to give you advice on something, you would have to pay service. You would have to pay sales tax on that. But if you're a big business that has attorneys in house, you don't. And so you end up with these incongruities, I guess, in the code. And they've got to work out some of these details. And to really to kind of try to tackle this in the fast paced 6-7 week session, it was just way too much for them to bite off. And so I think it's a good idea for them to take a little breather and try to, you know, think about this a little bit more calmly and rationally. When the state last did a major tax reform, it was back in 2008, 2009. And that was the product of a 4 or 5 year study that was initiated under Olean Walker, finally culminated in a big income tax cut during the Huntsman years. And so these are complicated issues, and it takes a lot of time.
But are there consequences of, you know, delaying, sort of ripping off that Band-Aid, facing facing the music?
Well, you've given the lobbyists a lot more time to sort of arm themselves, I guess, and bring the pressure to bear to try to, you know, protect their particular fiefdoms and industries. So I think that maybe creates a little bit more problem, but I do think you can get more data on the table and maybe make better decisions, hopefully.
Bethany, how did you cover this at the legislature, the attempt to try and get this passed through, and what kind of opposition did you see from sort of businesses, small businesses, or what angle did you cover at this story at the legislature?
The business angle mainly. There was, as we've talked about, opposition from almost every corner of the business community. You know, you sat there in the committee hearing, you were hearing from broadcasters who said that their TV stations wouldn't be able to survive, and you were hearing from travel agents who said that they weren't going to be competitive with people, you know, out of state. You're hearing from attorneys. You're really hearing from everybody about how this bill would impact them.
Hmm. There's a lot more we could get into here, but maybe let's save it for the interim session and when it actually shows up.
We're going to have plenty of time to talk about this, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. Before we head to a break, actually, Matt Canham, let's turn to a couple of stories related to the inland port that the Tribune reported on. And let's start at the legislature, a bill to expand the port and to make some other changes to how it operates. Boy, there's a lot of news this week because of the legislative session.
Yes.
That bill made some progress this week. What happened to it?
So right now, the idea of the inland port, this massive distribution hub, would be out near the airport in Salt Lake City. It's been very controversial. People are concerned about its impact on the environment and air quality, but they look at it as a huge economic driver for our state, or at least potentially. There is a bill of the legislature in the House that passed the committee that would create what they call a hub and spoke model, essentially allow other locales to get some of this development money to help move goods in and out of the state of Utah and throughout the western region.
What would be the hub and what would be the spokes?
So the idea would be that the inland port they're talking about would continue to be that hub, that central place where everything would move. But you'd spoke out to areas that have other economic interests. The environmental community looks at this as what they feared it would be, is getting coal, moving it through from Utah's coal country to the inland port and then out. The concern is that coal dust would blow off of trains and trucks and be a concern. But if you are one of these, you know, more rural areas and you see this huge economic development happening, you want your piece. So if you're Tooele County or Weber County, you want to be able to have some mini distribution hub that can help as part of this bigger system.
Okay. And as you said, these, you know, critics of the inland port aren't happy with this new design. There's more to this bill that would also change the board's policy on tax incentives as well. The board would get that 100% of property taxes
for 25 years instead of 15 years.
Or is it for longer than that?
It can go up to 40 years instead of 25,
yeah.
I was thinking,
so it's an additional 15 years beyond the 25 years. So that's maybe another cause of concern. And then there's also this sort of, this is going to turn into the next story that we'll try and quickly tackle before a break, but there's this sort of odd language about who can sue over the inland port. Can you tell us about that, Matt?
Yes. So it could be legislative bodies of the local governments, which essentially means not mayors.
Okay.
Not Jackie Biskupski. That's essentially what this is.
They should have just said that in the bill.
Jackie, not Jackie
everyone Biskupski. But Jackie can sue us. But this seems pretty targeted to the one mayor who's been very, very upset about this. Yeah. Has already blasted this bill.
But her council, the Salt Lake City Council, has not been as opposed to the inland port.
City Council is much more in favor and is actually in favor of this bill. They spoke in favor of it at the committee.
When it first came out, they were concerned about provisions of it. And when the bill first came out, it would have prohibited the council from suing as well. And it's a very broad language on the protection against litigation, because it does say it can't challenge any decision made by the port board ever, basically. And so it's not just sort of the formation of it. It's any decision the board makes. But they negotiated some of the provisions, to a place where the council at least is comfortable with it. The mayor is not. And there's some political intrigue, too, with two members of the board discussing on an open mic, a hot mic, whether getting Jim DeBacchus, who's running for mayor, involved would create dissent and animosity, and I think their words were something effective, make Jackie lose her mind.
Yeah. What was that? This is the second part of the story. There's this in a port board meeting, there's whispers between, they were caught on a recording between these two board members and Matt Canham. Who were they and what did they say? Gierke laid it out a little bit here.
Yeah. Derek Miller, who runs the Salt Lake Chamber, is also the board chairman for the Inland Port. And the vice chair is the Salt Lake City Councilman James Rogers. And they were whispering to each other about how crazy Jackie would get if Jim DeBacchus, who is a former state senator who was running for mayor against Jackie, decided to step in and say that he wanted to work with the city council and push the inland port forward. They talked about how the city council might respond. Miller said that he was going to reach out to Jim and talk to him, and Roger says that's a great idea.
Okay, go on.
Yeah. So I was just going to say that people who are critical of the inland port, including Dita Seed, a former Salt Lake City councilwoman, and the mayor, say this kind of political plotting isn't about good governance. It isn't about the right economic development program. It's just scheming against a politician who doesn't like what they're doing and shouldn't have happened. Jim's throwing his hands up saying, whoa, wasn't me. I had nothing to do with this. And that warns that they should back off a little bit.
There are two really interesting aspects to this. And one, I think the mayor raises a valid point that the board seems to be scheming, in private to try to cut her out or try to marginalize her in this whole discussion. And she is still the mayor of Salt Lake City, whether you like it or not. And so rather than deal with her in an upfront manner, they're trying to go behind her back and cut her out. The second thing is, let's remember that this is all taking place in the context of the mayoral campaign. Mm-hmm. And so when Jackie can then point to that and say, look at this, it probably hurts DeBacchus, even though he says he had nothing to do with it, and B, makes, engenders some sympathy to her both in the campaign aspect of it, but also in these ongoing negotiations. I think it's fascinating. The politics of it are just remarkable.
Well, and there's a background, too, in that it didn't Senator DeBacchus, well, sorry, former Senator DeBacchus, who I should disclose for the moment is a volunteer host of the KCPW political program, Both Sides of the Aisle. Didn't he strike a deal with then House Speaker Greg Hughes over advancing the inland port and keeping Salt Lake City sort of appeased?
Yeah, there was a lot of politics. The inland port was created by the last legislature very late in the session over the objections of Salt Lake City. And then there was some feeling that maybe we should tweak this bill and change it to make it a little bit more in favor of what the city's concerns are. And in that negotiation, you had, at the time, the House Speaker, Hughes, and a state senator, Jim DeBacchus, say they were going to craft some compromise in the middle. Didn't really push it as forward as far as they initially wanted.
But it did sort of lay the groundwork for the council to come in and negotiate this deal with Hughes.
I'm sorry that I have to cut us off and head to a break. There's a lot to unpack in this story on the Inland Port, and you can check it out at sltrib.com. But we are way behind in our show here, and more stories to cover. Listeners, follow us at kcpw.org. You can tweet us at kcpw to join in this conversation, or call us at 801-355-8255. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members. And Cash Arts presents Ballet Hispanico at the Ellen Eccles Theater, exploring the diversity of Latino cultures through contemporary dance. Monday, March 18th at 7:30 p.m. Ticket and seating information at casharts.org.
Take some of Celtic music's top names, Paul Brady, The Chieftains, The Pusies, Capper Cayley. Distill their recordings down to a pure essence, and what are you left with? The creme de la creme, the best of the best. Don't miss our gander through some of the best of compilations in Celtic music on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music. From ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course...
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting us at KCPW. Bethany Rogers, this week you reported on the story of Jason Harris. He's a Lehigh resident who uses medical cannabis. And before we get to his legal troubles, let's start with why he uses medical cannabis. What is he treating with his medical cannabis?
He said he has a cystic brain tumor that has, you know, caused a lot of sort of pain. He has migraines. He has digestive ailments. And medical cannabis has really helped to ease some of those symptoms.
Okay. And then he was arrested for having medical cannabis. This is after he was pulled over in a traffic stop. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yeah, he says he was rushing to work during a rush hour one day. He realized he was going too fast. He saw the cop come behind him and the lights went on. His heart sank. He pulled over and he didn't really think anything of it, rolled down the window to hand over the license and registrate his license and insurance. And the officer smelled cannabis in the car. And so kind of went south from there. He tried to explain, he said, that he was a medical user, but this was December 11th. So it was only, you know, a little over a week after the state's new medical cannabis law had gone into effect. So very new. And he said, honestly, the police officers just laughed at him when he tried to tell them that he was a patient.
Oh, wow. And he was we believe him to be the first person charged. So he's eventually charged with possession of marijuana and paraphernalia. We think he's the first person who's been charged after that law passed that broadly is meant to legalize medical marijuana.
Yeah. So there have been some other cases that have been written about where this law has kind of come into play in charges being dropped. But this is the first one that we know of where someone was prosecuted after the law took effect.
Okay. So he was facing criminal prosecution. But then there's the news this week, which is that he's not. I mean, all the charges, the counts against him are being dropped. Is that right?
They are. Yeah.
Okay. Why?
Well, the prosecutors determined that a jury would not convict him. Technically, even his own attorney says he was not in full compliance with the new medical cannabis law. In order to be protected, you have to follow some very strict rules, and they're very complicated. So, medical cannabis advocates are saying it's essentially impossible for anyone to follow the law to the T. So his problem was he, well, actually, he he did follow a lot of elements of the law. He had one of the qualifying conditions to be a cannabis patient. He had worked with his doctor, and he had a recommendation from his doctor to use medical cannabis. He was carrying an allowable amount of medical cannabis. The problem was that it was raw flower, and under the law, raw flower has to be packaged in a blister pack, which is kind of like what gum comes in that you
when
pop
you get
it out.
Cold medicine or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's dosed in a packet like that, and he was just kind of carrying it in a bag.
Where would he have gotten it legally to have been in a blister pack?
Well, that's sort of the problem, right? They've made it incredibly complex. While yes, there are protections in place in the law, they've made it incredibly complex in the form in which you can have it, and so I think that's one of the things. Senator Robles, I believe, has a bill that would change the blister pack requirement, mm-hmm. and it's something that all sides agree on, because right now there's just nowhere you can get it.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe you buy blister packs and put it in there.
That's exactly what advocates have said. You literally have to package it yourself. Buy raw flower, buy a blister pack off the internet, and then insert the raw flower into the blister pack in order to be in compliance.
Which is just silly, really, when you think about it.
But can you buy raw flower? I mean, this is a question that I have. Is that like something you can legally do in Utah?
Are you looking to buy some?
Well,
I know a guy.
Yeah, right.
No, it's a black market thing right now, right? Or else you bring it in from out of state, which technically is against federal law, but that's really the only place you can get it.
Okay.
And they don't, and the idea is that they don't ask questions if you're caught with it. If it's, obviously now in blister packs, it's a different story, but they just won't ask you. I mean, so you can have blister packs, you can have gummy cubes, not funny shapes, just cubes. And I believe oils and tinctures, right?
Yeah, oils and tinctures.
Exactly. Bears or whatever. Bethany, what does this mean, I guess, for future people who maybe, get caught, or those who have been caught? Does it mean anything? Can you apply what happened to Mr. Harris to others?
Yeah, I think what advocates are hoping here is that prosecutors recognize that, you shouldn't throw the book at people, that it's more of about the intent of the law and the spirit of the law than about following every tiny little element of the law. So if you have a patient who's making a good faith effort to do the right thing and to, follow this whole new law, then maybe don't prosecute them.
Hmm. Are we waiting on sort of the system that the state is putting forward to comply with this law? And how long are we waiting for that? I guess what's the next steps in terms of so-called, they're not called medical pharmacies anymore. They're called
dispensaries.
Yeah. I mean, this is just a long rollout. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you probably know the time frame better than I do. But I was talking to some of the advocates yesterday, and they said that the Ag Department is in the process of writing regulations for setting this program up. There's going to be licensing and inspection regimen that's going to have to be put in place. I believe we're talking about 2020 before we see their first mm-hmm. dispensary open.
Bethany's
Yeah, they're trying to get it done as quickly as possible, even ahead of the timeline. But yeah, I think January 2021 is like when they're supposed to, by law, have the first one open.
Yeah, and they're supposed to start rolling out rules, I think, in July of 2020.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Well, a new medical cannabis law and what it, what happens to people who have medical cannabis. This is an interesting story. Check it out at sltrip.com. We are at the end of the show and need to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Bethany Rogers, are you ready with an underplayed story?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that a House panel moves forward a bill that would call for the creation of a commission on a new state flag for Utah. So if that passes through, we could be seeing something new flying at the top of the flagpole.
I had a show about beehives in Utah, and it turns out, I had a conversation with a bee researcher, it turns out that most bees in the world don't actually live in or build hives or any, so I mean, just something to keep in mind as you design the new state flag.
Antisocial bees.
Antisocial bees who live in holes in the ground. Okay, Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
So Tony Samrat had a really interesting story yesterday about some intrigue involving a Draper housing project or proposal that's in the works. And there are allegations that two of the council members on the Draper Council were unduly influenced by the developer. And the mayor has commissioned an outside counsel to conduct an independent investigation into whether they were essentially, call it what it is, bribed to support this housing project. And so this is part of an ongoing battle on the Draper Council, where the, you know, or the council member, the mayor, and some of the, they just don't get along. The developers denied he did anything wrong, but it's kind of thrown a wrench into a works. The developer has actually said, "I've never seen anything like the animosity that, that exists on the, in this city government." So it's an interesting story. Check it out at sltrib.com.
Can I ask the alleged bribery? Was it, you know, cash payments? Was it sort of you get a house in this development? And also, how far along is that development?
It's a little unclear. I mean, one of the council members recused himself from the final decision or from further involvement in it because it turns out that the developer owns a physical rehabilitation company that his son had been going to, and there was some insinuation that the son had received treatment at a discount cost or maybe free. You know, so that's that, you know, so it's a little more, it's a little nuanced. Okay. It's not like there's briefcases full of cash.
Okay, great. Again, that is an interesting story. Check it out. Tony Semerad's story at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
This is a story from Jessica Miller. It's the latest in the saga about BYU's police department. We've been following this story for a while. At the core of it, a lieutenant named Rhodes was accessing police reports for non-investigative purposes, which is against the law, giving it to university administrators like those in the Honor Code office to investigate students who violated rules. This sparked a 2-year criminal investigation, but he was never charged. The investigation has been over for months. So we want to know, what did the investigation find? And we've been repeatedly denied, and they wouldn't tell us why. Finally, this week, we found out why. The state has a secrecy order in this case. We don't know why that would be in an investigation that is over. The person's not charged. It's already public what he did. But what we don't know is the scope of it. How many students' records did he go through? How many students were punished because of that? What implications did this investigation find?
And we don't know the origin of the secrecy order.
We don't even know what judge has made the secrecy order. This is highly unusual, and it's something the Tribune is going to continue to push.
And this is all happening in the context, too, of the BYU Police Department potentially being decertified by the state agency, right, that oversees police departments.
Because of this case.
This is the police officer standard in training.
Yeah.
Check that out at sltrib.com. We talked a little bit with Jessica Miller on the show last week about the overarching case and the decertification or potential decertification of the BYU Police. Check that out at kcpw.org. For my part, I think I'll go with a bill that would fund 17 free days on UTA buses and trains over the next 3 years. It got through the House and has cleared a Senate committee. The idea is to incentivize people using transit in advance of and during bad air quality days. It's measured by Representative Joel Briscoe. We will see what happens with it and with so much more in the final week of the legislative session coming up next week. Matt Canham, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan for their help. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local shows at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening, and have a great weekend.
This week in This American Life, you think you know what it might be like to have an autistic son. But you don't know. 12 years old, 250 pounds.
Just gets out of his seatbelt, takes his clothes off, pees in my car, poops in my car. My son Jake starts to gag. The dog's in there. I'm trying to prevent her from eating it. We're driving down the Edens. We get
stories of kids and the parents who still love them. No matter what.
Saturday morning at 11 on UPR.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.